Judging by her book sales, millions of Harry Potter fans consider author J.K. Rowling a genius. Rowling yesterday delivered the commencement address at Harvard University, but many graduating seniors grouse that she was unworthy of the honor. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
From the way she started, you might suppose that J.K. Rowling herself had doubts as to whether she was up to the challenge.
The first thing I would like to say is thank you. Not only has Harvard given me an extraordinary honor, but the weeks of fear and nausea I have endured have made me lose weight.
With humor and poise, Rowling went on to speak of the challenges she's overcome on the way to her success, and she extolled the power of imagination to help right wrongs around the world.
We do not need magic to transform our world. We carry all the power we need inside ourselves already. We have the power to imagine better.
She's a rock star. She's definitely a rock star.
When it was over, graduating senior Ross Lipstein, who basically grew up with Harry Potter, was as thrilled by Rowling as classmate Ken Ferguson was inspired.
She touched me, definitely, without a doubt. I was crying a little bit. I tried to fight it, but J.K. just brought it out.
But to other seniors, the guest of honor was, well, not quite magical.
Lame. I mean, like, I think we could have done better.
Computer science major Kevin Bombino says Rowling lacks the gravitas a Harvard commencement speaker should have.
You know, we're Harvard. We're like the most prominent national institution. We should be entitled to, I mean, we should be able to get anyone. And, you know, in my opinion, we're settling here.
Rowling was chosen by Harvard's alumni. President Drew Gilpin Faust applauded her for doing more than anyone to inspire young people to read. But senior John Hyman says she doesn't measure up to past commencement speakers like Microsoft founder Bill Gates, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, or other heavies in politics, science, and the arts.
She's not like a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. She writes children's books that are like very formulaic. And it's kind of like not in the same court of the things that we as Harvard students really talk about. I just don't feel J.K. Rowling is really kind of what we want here at Harvard.
That was a terrible thing to say. They're just a bunch of muggles.
Using the Harry Potter term for ordinary folks without the gift of magic, 10-year-old Alistair Beeson lobs one back at Rowling's critics. He skipped school, dressed up in his Harry Potter best, and flew in from New York to hear Rowling speak. He says Harvard seniors who have a problem with Rowling are actually the ones with the problem.
Booey on them for saying that she's not important.
They're just missing something, huh?
Yep, no common sense.
Maybe it just skipped a generation. Parents and alumni seem to see the wisdom in selecting Rowling. As 1983 graduate David Epstein put it, the grumbling just proves that even Harvard graduates still have a lot to learn.
They'll grow up. They'll continue to have a broader worldview and understand that there are many, many ways to contribute.
It just goes to show you don't know everything the day you graduate from Harvard?
Well, that's what they say, is that the freshmen bring so much, the seniors take away so little.
That very notion makes many at Harvard cringe. As one graduate put it, we're going out in the world now, and all this arrogance and grousing about J.K. Rowling isn't going to help our reputation as a bunch of intellectual snobs. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Photojournalist Bill Eppridge captured Robert F. Kennedy in every possible political setting, speaking through a bullhorn, signing autographs, hanging off the back of a campaign convertible, and always reaching his hand out to adoring crowds as many hands reach back to touch him. And Bill Eppridge remembers well the first photograph. He was on assignment for Life magazine with President Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One when he spotted Robert Kennedy doing something no candidate wants to be photographed doing, puffing on a cigar.
And I took the camera out very quietly and grabbed a couple pictures. The magazine ran one, not very big. Later on, about 10 or 11 months later, the magazine then assigned me to photograph Bob Kennedy campaigning in 1966. I went and I introduced myself to the senator, told him what I wanted to do. I said, I want to stick right with you. And he looked at me kind of funny. He says, okay, but no cigars, huh? And I just, he remembered me.
What was Bobby Kennedy like as a subject?
He was a gentleman. And as a subject, he did something that I really love, and it's the way I've worked all my life, is that he did nothing special for me. He ignored me. And by ignoring me, he allowed me to photograph moments that were really true moments, not set up, not photo ops, but just moments that happened, and I loved it.
One of those moments would turn out to be the most tragic of them all. Bill Eppridge was with Bobby Kennedy the night he was shot 40 years ago, and he would end up taking an iconic photograph showing a fallen Bobby Kennedy. His arms are outstretched, a glow of light illuminates his head, and a young man kneels beside him. Senator Kennedy had just given a victory speech at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles after winning the California presidential primary. He was poised to become the Democratic nominee. And as always, Bill Eppridge was on assignment for life.
It was a closing day for the magazine. Time was tight. Film had to be out on the plane. And they said, shoot nothing but black and white. And they said, stick as close as you can. When the senator was finished speaking, the exit that we were going to go out was across the ballroom. And the photographers usually formed a wedge in front of the candidate so that we backed through the crowd and gave him room to shake hands. Senator came off the stage. The bodyguard said, Senator, this way, pointing to the door. And I remember, because I was right next to him, Bob Kennedy said, no, this way, and turned and went to the right, to the kitchen. And he had no protection in front of him.
And then the shooting started.
I got through the curtain into the kitchen, and I first heard two shots, and I just turned to my left, and there was a senator lying there. And at that point, my profession changed. I became a historian.
You shot the picture, really, that showed him down and dying.
I was standing there looking and suddenly realized that what I was seeing there was an icon, almost. It was almost like a crucifixion.
A key part of the picture, there's a busboy with his white shirt and his arm kind of cradling Bobby Kennedy's head.
Yes. The busboy that was holding him, Juan Romero, I made three frames of that situation. And the third one, he's looking up and there's this look of, you know, help on his face. And that was the one. That was the picture that grabbed everybody.
When Ethel Kennedy came into that space, you write that she asked that all the photographers leave.
Yes.
You didn't.
No.
And you didn't stop shooting pictures either.
What I did in respect was I backed up into the crowd to hold them back. People were pressing in and they needed to be held back. But every once in a while, I would reach around and click the shutter on the camera that was hanging around my neck. I never put it up to my eye. I shot from the hip and came up with one quite acceptable picture.
Do you feel like it was the right thing to do, to take those last pictures when you weren't even supposed to be taking them?
I know it was the right thing to do. I think that that kind of a situation has got to be documented. It has to be told. And it has to be told to people who do not understand the horrors that we can face.
Robert F. Kennedy's assassination wasn't the end of the story for you as a photographer. There are other pictures that came later of crowds gathering as the train that carried Bobby Kennedy's casket passed by.
One in particular that shows the whole thing was a picture taken in Baltimore. As the train passed through, and it goes over a rather wide street, down below are cars lined up, many people standing in the middle of the street, and these people had probably waited for a couple of hours, yet they couldn't see the inside of the train. And for them to wait that long is a sign that he affected many, many people in many ways.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Renee.
Photojournalist Bill Eppridge. You can see those photographs and hear more about his travels with the candidate at npr.org. Robert F. Kennedy died 26 hours after he was shot on this day, 40 years ago.
This week's reporting from the city of Karachi has reminded us of one of the realities of traveling abroad. When you're in America, Pakistan seems very far away. When you're in Pakistan, America seems very near. Visit the poorest neighborhood in the most remote part of town, and somebody will have an opinion about American policies. More affluent Pakistanis travel back and forth to the U.S., and one of Pakistan's biggest music stars grew up in America. Salman Ahmad leads the group Janoon. You're hearing their music now. His father moved around as an employee of Pakistan International Airlines.
I mean, think about this. I was 11 years old when I came to New York. You know, like millions of other kids who were grown up on Zeppelin and Aerosmith, you know, I wanted to be a rock star. And then to be taken from that place and moved to Pakistan, which was alien to me now.
You went back to Pakistan after high school?
Well, you know, I joined a garage band called Eclipse. And I started playing the guitar 14 hours a day. And my mother, who, like all South Asian mothers, freaked out. And she realized that her dream of seeing her son as a doctor was going to dissipate unless she sent me back to Pakistan. You know, in the middle of a military dictatorship of General Zia, I studied at King Edward Medical College. Pakistan had changed significantly from the 70s. And I landed in the middle of that nightmare.
Salman Ahmad and his friends went to medical school at a time when Pakistan's military government was imposing a more conservative view of Islam.
There was a bunch of us, about 60 of us, who decided that hell with these mullahs. So we decided to hold a talent show, like a gong show. You remember that show?
Sure.
And we kept it very secret. I got up, and the thing I knew how to play was Van Halen's Eruption. And I closed my eyes and I heard this almighty roar. And I thought these kids are loving it. But what had happened was that the jihadis had found out that there was this place of obscenity and vulgarity where girls and guys were sitting together. So they came, covered the girls with burqas and chadars. And one of them came up on stage and he grabbed my cheap copy of my Les Paul, my first guitar I ever had, and he smashed it on the ground. Mm. And first of all, I thought, wait a minute, I was supposed to do that. I mean, and so it made me think, if music bothers these guys so much, I should do more of it, you know?
I don't see lyrics that are overtly political, even though you have become, in some sense, a political figure or at least someone who stands for something.
During that time, those 5 years I was in medical school, I dove into the poetry of the Sufi poets. Mm-hmm. Like Rumi and from the South Asia, Baba Bulleh Shah. And he wrote his first poem, which was Who Am I? Where he says, if I translate the Punjabi, I'm no believer in a mosque. I have no pagan ways. I'm not pure. I'm not vile. I'm no Moses. I'm no Pharaoh. Who am I?
You took that. You turned that into a song, didn't you?
Yeah. It's on our album, Parvaz, The Flight. That was a big turning point for me. But I wasn't thinking ever of a political, you know, it just became political because we got really big.
Did living in Karachi make you or force you to be more political?
Well, you know, Steve, you just couldn't escape it. You know, you saw such tremendous poverty, plus the violence of Karachi, the day-to-day violence, the sectarian violence, the political violence. I remember when we were doing our album, Inqilab, which means revolution, we'd go to the studio, which is on the other side of town, and, you know, I saw a political murder in front of my eyes.
Salman Ahmad said he was threatened, too, by members of the MQM. That's the political party that runs Karachi. Its leader is a man we met on this program earlier this week, Altaf Hussein.
It went like this. One of their activists, he called up and he said that our leader, Altaf Hussein, loves your music and he would like for you to come and perform at his wedding. And I told him, I said very nicely that I don't, you know, go and play at people's weddings, especially political leaders who are corrupt, like your leader. And so he lost it. And he said, you know, if you want to live in Karachi, you have to deal with the MQM. And by a stroke of good luck for me, ill luck for him, this guy got wiped out by the other faction of the MQM. You know, so, you know, he didn't live long enough to carry out that threat. But that's happened many, many times. That impacted the music in a big way.
In what way?
Well, it made me think, what do I want to say in the music that we sing? And, you know, there's a song called Talash, which is on our second album, which is an overtly political song. I mean, the lyrics, basically that, if I could translate, Tapti Dhoop Tale Chhaon Ki Hai Talash. Under a burning sun, there's a search for shade. Taasub Ki Dhool Thame To Mile Shanaat. And this is difficult to translate, but literally it says, once we get over the fighting, we'll find our identity.
You know, I'm just thinking about cities that I love, and if I think about New York City, it has also been a very violent place and a grim and unhappy place in many ways, and yet I love the city. Is there something about Karachi that transcends the poverty and the violence that is so obvious there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a spirit of resilience in the city, in the people. You know, you say, well, you know, we're going to face this and no matter what, and we're going to carry on with our lives. Parties, weddings, you know, because there's no, you're not going to say, well, we'll wait for the violence to end so that we can get on with our lives. No, it has to go on at the same time.
That's Salman Ahmad, frontman for the Pakistani rock band Janu. You can find all the stories in our Urban Frontier series at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Karachi, Pakistan.
And I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West. And Steve will be back home in Washington next week.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. On any given day, about 500,000 children in the U.S. live in foster care. Often they're victims of severe abuse and neglect by their parents, and many of the kids end up in foster care programs that have problems of their own. We have several stories now on efforts to improve foster care and the people behind those efforts. First, a study published this week explores what it takes to create a successful foster care system, a system which helps children heal psychologically and physically. The study appears in the Archives of General Psychiatry, and Michelle Trudeau has our story.
A child is placed in foster care only as a last resort when parental maltreatment or neglect is extreme and unremitting. Such abuse has long-term consequences. Sociologist Ronald Kessler of Harvard Medical School investigated two groups of foster care children from Oregon and Washington State. They were adults who'd been raised in foster care from childhood through their teenage years. One group had been placed in the state-run public foster care system, and the other group was placed in a private program with expanded services.
We traced both groups of kids to see how they turned out as adults.
Both groups had similar social and economic backgrounds. They'd been placed in either the standard state program or the expanded private program, depending on space availability. Kessler says they turned out very differently.
The people who were alumni of the more intensive program had dramatically better mental health and physical health than the people who were in care in the conventional program.
Significantly less hypertension, heart disease, ulcers, chronic pain, and headaches.
They had 50% lower rates of depression and anxiety disorders and substance disorders.
So what made the difference? A whole list of things, including that caseworkers in the private program were better trained, earned higher salaries, had lower caseloads. The kids got more services, such as mental health counseling, tutoring in school, summer camps. And the foster parents received more financial assistance and support, even some parent training. Of course, these expanded services cost more, about 60% more. But Kessler says the benefits outweigh the cost.
The outcomes are more than 60% better. You really get a dramatic, dramatic increase in the quality of the outcomes for the kids in the model program.
But with the foster care system already costing the country well over $5 billion a year, it's perhaps more realistic, Kessler says, to target these expanded services at foster children who are particularly vulnerable.
We're now going in and digging into the data and saying, is there some subset of kids who it really makes a big difference for and others that it doesn't?
Research psychiatrist Charles Nemeroff at Emory University agrees and suggests that the target group should be children who have experienced the trauma of parental abuse and inherited a genetic vulnerability to depression or anxiety. This group would be the most likely to suffer lasting health problems as adults and the most likely to benefit from an expanded, encompassing foster care program. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Karachi, Pakistan.
And the population there is estimated anywhere from 12 to 18 million and counting. Steve, you've been there all week reporting on the growth of this, one of the world's largest cities. And I might add, introducing us to some of the more memorable characters there in Karachi.
Yeah, they're the people that shape this city, which is violent but also wealthy. We've met a hard-driving mayor. We've met an activist who risked her life. And we've also met newcomers who pay most of their income for two-room houses and a tiny patch of sand to call their own. We've met all of them on what we call the Urban Frontier, our series on the world's changing cities.
And Steve, one thing we've learned from you is that despite all this city's problems, it's attracting a lot of investment.
Yeah, some of which we're going to hear about this morning. The other day we went to Karachi's waterfront, which is beautiful, and we looked at some newly created land. There's a company called Imar, which is from the Persian Gulf city of Dubai. It reclaimed this land to make space for about 45 towers. And here's their managing director for Pakistan.
As you can look out here, we're now starting the excavation for seven of the towers right now. We just built the land, now we're taking it out.
The man's name is Steve McCart. And if he doesn't seem to have much of a South Asian accent, that's because he was born in Texas. So you have an American working for a Persian Gulf company building thousands of condo apartments in Karachi. And he took us to see a model apartment inside the Imar sales building here.
You're going to enter Southern California right now. We've learned that the market in this part of the world absolutely loves California. As a matter of fact, all these products actually came from California and shipped over.
Well, this is quite an apartment. So it's a two-bedroom apartment that you've created here. You've got the kitchen table.
This is
you've
one
got
bedroom.
The kitchen, one-bedroom apartment.
And where are you in the world? You don't know necessarily. Is this Karachi specific? No, not at all.
Imar's research shows this is what affluent Pakistanis want. And whatever its problems, the city has plenty of affluent home buyers. They range from contractors to stockbrokers, and plenty of other people, from soldiers to politicians to various kinds of traders, have sources of income they never declare.
Okay. We're going to go out from the sales center. We're going to get in the cars and go onto the site.
Okay.
There's absolutely nothing like this going on in the U.S., and if you did, it would take 15 years to approve it. So this is, you know, you're sort of the excitement of going ahead and being able to develop and create from, you know, from a blank slate, really something special.
And Renee, Steve McCart took us across that blank slate, this 100 and more acres of brand new land. Pakistan's military only provided Imar with beachfront, and that's all they said they needed. Imar began reclaiming land, pouring rock and sand into the ocean to create all these acres. And the company seized its opportunity as part of a $3 billion investment in Pakistan. Some people might say, what are you talking about, doing business in this place that they can't even keep the electricity on, they have no clean water, they have horrible violence? I mean, how do you deal with those issues?
Well, you got to start somewhere. You know, you wish you had a power grid that was constant. You wish that you didn't drink bottled water. But the more you build these markets into an international market, the more those things will go away because they have the resources to bring in the infrastructure that works.
Okay, a real estate executive there in Karachi giving you, Steve, a tour of a new development there. You said something about Pakistan's military providing beachfront. What does the military have to do with that?
Well, the military owns a lot of the best real estate in Karachi, including that beachfront. And what happens is the military has land reserved for it. Retiring military officers get pieces of that land, which they can use to build a house or to sell instantly at a huge profit and become mini real estate tycoons. In fact, Imar is building on a part of the city that is called Defense, because it is military land. It's a peninsula that keeps getting longer and longer because they keep adding more land to it. It's very similar to what was done years ago in Lower Manhattan in New York City. Now, the best way to get a look at this land is by boat. The boat was called the Al Jungli, which translates as wild man. The wild man in question is the owner of the boat, Tariq Alexander Kesa, who is a successful architect. We came also with a contractor friend of his, Adnan Asdar, who's been involved with a number of Karachi's signature buildings. And something became clear to us as we floated past the military's developments, high skyscrapers, as well as an all-night golf course with stadium lights. There's been so much focus on whether Pervez Musharraf stays or goes as president. Is it fair to say that the military is so involved in business and has so much power in business that it almost doesn't matter whether a general or ex-general is in charge of the country?
Absolutely, it doesn't matter at all.
These developments are big, we should say. They're impressive. They include a desalination plant to turn seawater into drinking water for this growing city. They include a lot of upscale apartments, and there's a lot of vacant land still to go. But Tariq did not always like what he saw there.
Development is good,
okay, but it has to be done sensitively.
And he doesn't necessarily think, as an architect, that all of Karachi's developments have been that sensitive.
But Steve, aren't these people who've profited from Pakistan's system?
Yeah, but they'd like to improve it, and they're thinking about the quality of life in their city and ways to make it better rather than just richer. Now, Renee, when we got back ashore, Adnan Asdar led the way to his car and then led the way to dinner with him and his family in a cool, elegant house in town. They've got these big living room windows, and outside you see these lovely little reflecting pools. It's a gorgeous house. He's married to a successful architect, and just before dinner was served, they sat together on the couch to talk.
My name is Mehboob Khan, and I was born in Karachi, and I live in Karachi, and I work in Karachi.
Which, Renee, is where she just finished a difficult day, dealing with the kind of hotels and shopping malls that keep her firm afloat, in fact, make her a lot of money, but they're not that close to her heart.
I hope none of my clients will ever get to hear this, but unfortunately, the bottom line is the money, you know, how much they can earn and what will sell, and it's to the last cent that they count their monies. You know, I think this capitalistic fever generates out of your country, you know.
America, you mean?
Yeah, and that's where it started, and we've all become part of that global hunger for money.
Hey, we're in the dark.
Yeah.
The power just went out. That's fine. We can continue our conversation. It's radio.
Kids, bring the generator out. Go.
We don't have a generator.
When you say bring the generator, they're going to bring a flashlight or a candle?
Yes. That's it. That's the running joke.
My wife in particular, she doesn't want a generator in this house because we feel that I think the rest of the city is suffering, and the kids and everybody should learn how to be able to.
I'll tell you one thing, Steve. You've met us at a point where we want to change directions, okay? I love my work. I love my family. I love my husband. I love my country. I love my city, okay? But right now, I wanted to change directions for the next 20 years of my life, and hopefully God will give me next 20 years to do it.
What they want to do, Renee, is reorient their architecture and construction firms. And over the coming years, they both plan to spend more time designing and building low-income housing. They want to build houses that are cheap enough for almost anybody in Karachi to afford, but pleasant enough that people will want to live there.
And Steve, that's a noble idea, but also one that, given the size of Karachi's population, probably could be quite a profitable life's work.
They say it could be profitable. My question to them was, look, we've just been out, and we've heard in this program yesterday about people who can only pay $5,000 for a house. And I said, can you really give them a nice house for a price they can afford and make money at it? And they said, yes, with creative architecture and with the right people involved, they believe they can.
Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep has reported all week from Karachi, Pakistan, and looking forward to having you back next week, Steve.
Me too.
All our reports are available at npr.org. The reporting team for our first installment of The Urban Frontier included Tracy Wall and Junaid Budahar Khan. Off the coast of Hawaii yesterday, a Navy warship shot a missile out of the sky. NPR's Mike Schuster was there to watch this test of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. It's part of the overall national missile defense capability that the Bush administration has spent billions of dollars to deploy. The target was not the kind of missile that would likely carry a nuclear warhead. Instead, this would be an enemy missile carrying chemical or biological weapons that could be used in the Middle East or on the Korean Peninsula against cities or troop concentrations. Mike was aboard the USS Lake Erie.
It was a glorious fresh morning in the Pacific, about 50 miles from the coast of Kauai. The sun was brilliant, the sea a sparkling deep blue. Shortly after 8, an alert crackled through the Lake Erie and its more than 300 sailors. Fireball, the code word for a hostile missile launch. The Lake Erie was assigned a watch sector in the Pacific, and a missile was launched from it. In this case, a target missile coming off a mobile launch platform about 300 miles away. The Lake Erie now had about 4 minutes to track it and train its own missiles on the incoming rocket. On the ship's bridge, a palpable tension as the assembled officers and seamen keep their eyes on the forward deck, where the missiles are kept in cells below deck. That's where the ship's missiles will launch. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. 2 missiles away, amidst a burst of orange flame that covers the bridge's windows for an instant, the sailors crowd toward the port side of the ship.
There they go. Beautiful.
2 minutes later, the Lake Erie's missiles engage the target missile, which is speeding at several thousand miles an hour, after it's traveled into space and then re-entered the atmosphere. Lieutenant Commander Andrew Bates, the officer of the day, says the shot is right on the mark.
We could see an explosion around the first missile that was launched. At the same time that I visually saw the explosion, I heard over the internal nets the missile system supervisor say, "Mark India," so mark intercept.
It took a few minutes for the vast array of sensors and computers and satellites and specialists to confirm that, in fact, the test had been a success. The Lake Erie's captain, Ron Boxall, was delighted.
I'm suffering from post-shot euphoria. You know, we plan for so many different contingencies. You know, you can see how overly conservative we are in our planning because it went off without a hitch. We kind of learn to expect things to go wrong, and when they don't, it doesn't seem normal.
It seems that things are tending to go right with the component of missile defense that's based at sea on Aegis cruisers like the Lake Erie. The Aegis system has carried out test intercepts against intermediate-range missiles, destroying them in space, and now shorter-range missiles, knocking them out when they re-enter the atmosphere. The Lake Erie also used its missiles in February to shoot down a crippled U.S. spy satellite that was threatening to fall out of orbit. Yesterday's launch was meant to demonstrate the system's ability to protect the U.S. or others from short- to medium-range missile attack, explained Stanley Williams, the Pentagon's top civilian aboard the Lake Erie.
Somewhat like the Scuds from the Desert Shield, Desert Storm, that we can engage and protect a friendly neighbor, whether we're in the Gulf or the Sea of Japan or elsewhere in the world.
In fact, the Pentagon later described the target missile that was shot down as a Scud-like object. The Aegis cruiser has become an increasingly important part of the Navy's inventory of ships. It was first produced in the 1970s and was originally equipped with a lot of high-tech sensing equipment, including the phased array radar. Over the past 15 years, the radar has become even more sophisticated, and computer technology has integrated the information from the ship's radar and from satellites with an array of guided missiles. Only after President Bush took office did the Pentagon decide to see whether the Aegis system could be modified to include ballistic missile intercepts. Now it looks like the Pentagon is moving quickly to outfit some 18 Aegis cruisers and destroyers with missile interceptors and the necessary technology to operate them. Some may be ready by October, the rest over the next 20 months, said Rear Admiral Brad Ricks in a Pentagon conference call after yesterday's test.
The beauty and the criticality of this test is it allows you to add to our defense in depth. It allows us to kill in space and in the atmosphere from a single platform, being an Aegis warship in this case.
The ability of the U.S. to intercept long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, which could carry nuclear warheads, has had its problems, though. The U.S. has now deployed a small number of ground-based interceptors in Alaska and in California, but so far their test record has been less successful. Mike Schuster, NPR News, aboard the USS Lake Erie off Hawaii.